Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this will be a fun one.
Yeah, it is. We have a full studio today.
Full house. Yesterday, you got to do your first Thought Leader Radio episode.
I did. It was fun.
How was that?
It was good. It went well. It was a good call-in interview from Virginia.
Call-in interviewing amazing women doing amazing things all over the country.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Good stuff. But it's not going to be as fun as this.
No.
Got a room full. We're going to kick it off with Jill Luber with LexisNexis Risk Solutions, and we'll hit Shane King with Three Squared, and then we'll end with Dean Monteleone at Karen, and that'll be a fun way to end this. First up, we got Jill Luber. Welcome, Jill.
Thank you.
Can you share a little bit about LexisNexis Risk Solutions? How are you serving folks?
Sure, absolutely. We are a global provider of data technology and analytics leader in risk assessment. So our customers range in market from your banks, government institutions, insurance carriers, and generally as we're helping businesses, we're actually helping consumers.
So now, how'd you get into this line of work? You're good at math? Like, how's this happen?
Absolutely, yeah. So actually, I personally was a computer engineer.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So I started actually as an engineer for LexisNexis and have been with the company for 15 years and worked up to the role I hold today, which is vice president.
Now, in we do a lot of work with women in technology, and that we find through those interviews, we learned that that's a male-dominated industry.
It is.
Is it the same in this world?
Absolutely. It's not. I mean, it's no mystery that there's a gender gap in technology for women across the board, and there's for several years now we've been trying to correct that issue.
Now, what was it like for you personally? Like, how did you feel that? Did you feel like a gender gap happening when you were going through school?
I could see the gender gap.
Well, you see it. It's obvious in the classroom. It.
Absolutely, yeah. In the classroom, a lot of times I was the only female in a computer engineering or electrical engineering class. Mm-hmm. Personally, I never felt it. I never felt like I was not an equal.
But what was it like for your peers? Like at this, I know that it's true. It's just I'm curious on how that split occurred. At some point, there were other girls,
right,
with you, and then at some point there weren't,
right?
Like, do you have any thoughts or theories on how that occurred?
How it occurs,
or like why? Yeah. Like, what's the pressure that some are dropping out and others are not?
I would say there's several things. Lack of role models, I would say, has a big impact on it. Especially when I was going through school. Which I won't tell you how long ago that was.
Okay.
But there were certainly less celebrated women in this technology space. So that's actually something I would like to see is more
of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just at today, you'll see a lot of when people say women in technology, you'll see a lot of CEOs pop up in technology. And I think that's great. And I think that we should have more.
Right.
I would also like to see more architects, more statisticians,
right. So like
more scientists.
At all levels. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Across the board. You know, to be successful as a woman in technology does not mean that you have to be at the C level.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that that's the end-all, be-all of being successful as a woman in technology, right? We really do still need those system architects, the statisticians. That is success for a woman.
And then I know through the Women in Technology group, they put a lot of effort in kind of have job shadowing and having those type of experiences for young girls to be able to see the people at different levels and actually what a day in their life looks like.
Absolutely. And mentorship is a huge piece of it, too. And that actually is an important part of even some of the programs that we have at LexisNexis Risk Solutions. Our Tomorrow's Technology Camp, which is trying to teach technology to the youth across Atlanta. In particular, we have a 4-week coding and mentoring program that's completely free to students. And part of that program includes a mentor from our company that's a volunteer, And even after the camp is over, when the students are also given a laptop to continue their education in technology, they're also given a mentor.
Wow.
And yeah, that mentor...
That's a big investment.
It is a huge investment for Lexis, but we certainly believe that it's important. We really think that technology should be taught in classrooms the same way reading and math, right? It should be that all children also get exposure, because that's the world we live in now. Technology is not the future, it's the present. And having children have that ability to have the technology, again, we're giving them the experience, we're giving them the laptops, but giving them that mentor as well, especially important back to your point of young women. And young women is having someone that they can talk to and that can encourage them to stay in that technology field, I think is very important.
So now how does an initiative like this kind of take form?
At LexisNexis Risk Solutions, right. So we're certainly.
Were you part of the creation of this initiative?
I was not part of the creation, no. But certainly, I think it's important for our company to have initiatives like this. And I think, you know, again, the 29 WIMP students who were in the program, almost half were women, right? And it's because of, again, it's just seeking out the groups that don't have this exposure naturally. And there are schools that have it naturally and some that don't, mm-hmm. right? So in the case where it's not natural, I think it was our mission, our duty to help the technology go down to the kids who don't have that ability.
And then it's important to not just kind of give it lip service and talk about it, but to actually mm-hmm. reach out and be proactive in encouraging people to take part in it.
Absolutely. And I said it's more than just the summer camp. You're one and done. It's beyond that, right?
Right.
So you can continuing to have these relationships with children to encourage them to answer questions, to really be there in case they have like started doubts. Well, maybe I don't want to go in this field,
or I'm not good enough, or like they have one hard class or one teacher that isn't great, and all of a sudden they think that it's not for them,
then
and they could abandon
it. That's right. That's exactly right. All right. So it's the encouragement, I think, is more valuable than the class itself.
Did you have a chance to be a mentor?
I have not been a mentor yet. Yeah, certainly something that I would love to consider. Again, looking at our numbers of how many people and how many were women, I think it's a great opportunity. I definitely mentor within the company. So mm-hmm. we have young women who right out of college who start as engineers, and I've had many opportunities to mentor within the company.
Is that part of the culture of the company?
Absolutely. Absolutely part of the culture. That culture, I will say that I did start, right? That was my initiative. It's been probably 4 or 5 years now that I created a mentorship program. It was not geared for women. It was actually geared across the board to help our, it's a retention tool, certainly, and also finding young potentials and keeping them engaged and making sure that their engagement and their contributions are actually heard and used throughout the company. And I've mentored a few women, actually. And in fact, one that I mentored is going through the process right now to be promoted to an architect for LexisNexis Risk Solutions. So I found that it's very rewarding for myself to see the success there.
Right, when you see the impact.
Absolutely.
Now, for companies out there that are listening that are thinking about starting a mentorship program, do you have any advice for them?
It's very easy. It's cheap, right? Yeah.
It takes a lot of time and emotional time, too, right?
It does.
Not just like you're checking a box. You have to kind of really care about
That's
the person.
Right.
You want
That's
them to succeed.
Right. It's easy to do. I'd say the hardest part is getting people to – you're going to get mentees – say, yes, I would like to do it. You're harder time to find the mentors, right? So you got to encourage the ones who are higher up in the ranks. So mm-hmm. this is valuable. The pairing, you know, it is a relationship.
Right.
Right. So
how do you do that matchmaking?
Yeah, it's a little trial and error, right? You look at backgrounds. What are you interested in? What have you done in the company? Where they link up? Sometimes you would say things like I mentioned, as a female, having a female mentee is important. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's actually more helpful for a young woman to have a mentor that is male to help kind of pull her up, kind of bringing her to the table in situations that she wouldn't naturally be there, mm-hmm. that other men would naturally be there. That's the gender bias that we live with today. Other things I would encourage for the mentor program is when you're having a hard time finding mentors, even you don't realize how much you get out of it as the mentor as well, right? I got so much information. I learned lessons. I got experiences being a mentor that I never would have gotten otherwise, right? So you can't devalue, to your point, it's a lot of time. But at the same time, it's a great learning experience. And actually, one of the ways we did it in at LexisNexis is that the mentors got quote unquote credit for being a mentor as well, right? That's your own personal development plan, and
right.
that was part of your it's not just box checking. Again, it's like what areas do you need to work on? If one of them is like connecting with others in the company, it's an easy way to say, okay, go be a mentor,
right.
and see how that works.
Now, is when you're doing a mentorship program, is it like if I'm in accounting, should I mentor somebody in accounting, or is it good to be cross-functional?
That's a good question. Our program was strictly within technology, and while it's not as diverse as what you were just saying across from accounting to technology, even within technology, you have different groups,
mm-hmm.
and we did mix. So you may have a network person with a data person.
Right. So that way it kind of helps some empathy to understand what each group is going through,
yep.
and then maybe not you don't fully understand their
That's
pains
exactly
that
right.
they're having, right?
So that was back to my point of the mentor learning. Like I said, I learned so much because I was mentoring people who were in a different group than me.
Right.
And I learned about tell me what you do and tell me the problems you're having. And all of a sudden I learned about problems that were in that group that I had no idea. And like now I can even help that group.
Right.
I had no idea that they were facing
right.
these issues. Right.
And then it might be something like, oh, that's an easy fix for you. But to them, it was like almost in.
That's exactly right.
Frustrated.
Yeah, like this. Exactly. Like they would never allow me to do X, Y, and Z. Like, of course
really?
They would. Yeah.
Let me make
right.
a call.
That's
now,
right.
Now, are you finding that when people go through the mentorship, the people who are the mentors, are they kind of stepping up and really sponsoring the person? Because it's one thing mm-hmm. to say, okay, I'm going to mentor and I'm going to listen and be nice and that. But it's another
that's
thing
right.
to put kind of political capital on the line and say, you know what? We're going to get this
That's
person
right.
up here.
Mm-hmm.
They deserve this.
Absolutely. So another piece of the program is when the mentee is ready for a promotion to a next level. Again, I was talking about
right.
the architect role. It is the job of the mentor to be the sponsor for that
okay.
promotion. What that means is the mentor is the one who's saying, I'm vouching for this,
right.
right? This person's ready for this job. We have a business need for this position. This is the right person. Here's why. They come first in front of right, the board, the deciding factor to say this is the right person for the job. And it's, like I said, it's really on them to say I'm the one who's vouching for the person.
And that's where you're going to get those biases will kind of be lessened, I would think, that when you have that take place.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And for the mentor, again, it's you actually can't express how much I personally benefited from the experience that I got out of it and having... You know, I had some accountability with
right.
these mentees as well, right? These are, you know, it becomes later when they do something good or bad,
right.
right? This was Jill's person,
right. right?
So I definitely felt some accountability and I really wanted to see the person succeed.
Now, does LexisNexis Risk Solutions, is there a talent challenge for you guys or are you mm-hmm. finding enough talent here, either local, or I don't know if you're pulling mostly
right.
from Georgia or you're getting people from all over the planet.
We are all over the planet. Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Global company. I can speak locally. I have had great experience out of many of the local universities. Nice to have Georgia Tech in the area. We've also hired out of Kennesaw State. We've really had been very successful lately. The economy helps
right.
there as well, that we've got more people available. I think the talent is there. Making sure that people realize that, especially in the tech world, we are East Coast, and there is a lot to be said about an East Coast technology group, right? Not everything, you know, not every...
Talk about bias. So there's a West Coast bias in
this
world.
There is a West Coast bias in the industry, for sure, right? Again, if you talk to kids, you'll go to the career fairs, and kids want to go West Coast. Like, that's their goal, going mm-hmm. to West Coast. And so there's definitely a recruiting a challenge there, but I think an easy story of the East Coast, right? There's a lot to offer here. West Coast is a great big pond, right? There's a lot of fish in that pond,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's a lot to offer
East
Coast.
It's an expensive pond to live in, too.
It is a very expensive pond, right? Absolutely, yeah. So as I said, there's lots of benefit to staying East Coast and staying here in our LexisNexis Risk Solutions office, which is actually in Alpharetta, just mm-hmm. north of the city. So I said, there's some challenges there. It's less about, is there talent out there? The talent's there. I would say our biggest challenge is making sure they stay local.
And then when you're recruiting talent, do you find that, can you work with the universities and create curriculum that's bubbling up the people with the skills you need?
Yeah. We've actually partnered with universities, and we have an open source solution, our HPCC Systems, mm-hmm. which is our open source technology. And we have actually partnered with universities, and we're actually teaching the programming languages in the colleges.
So you have LexisNexis people?
We have professors that are, they're not our employees, right? It is the college, but we've sponsored with them, partnered with the college mm-hmm. to help teach the language, the open source solution that we have, so that it's a skill that these students have as they graduate.
And then, so the benefit, or one of the benefits for you, is then when they graduate, they're already
absolutely
kind of running now.
They're job ready.
Right?
That's right. That's it. That's a huge piece for us, right? And having the skill set as you walk in the door and you're not having to go through a training is, you know, being effective as you walk in is a huge benefit for us.
Now, are universities open to that? Are you finding that that's something that they're appreciative of? And they
absolutely, yeah.
It's
absolutely.
Kind of a win-win, right? Because now they're getting the yeah. students kind of job ready.
They are. There's that. And there's also, you know, universities want to be relevant. They want to make sure that they're offering the right courses and the right skill sets to attract students as well.
Right. And it makes sense for them from a business side to have that kind of relationship with actual business doing mm-hmm. the actual work. It's not this theoretical, hypothetical
That's
world
right.
that the professor might have been
That's
part
right. it's
of
not
10
all theory.
Years ago.
That's
right.
exactly right. Right. Again, that's my point about being relevant. Uh-huh. And it's important to students.
So now for LexisNexis Risk Solutions, what's on tap for you guys?
What I really want to talk about today is some of our programs that we have to benefit society.
That's pretty big.
It is. There are lots of examples, missing children, identity theft, money laundering, crime, healthcare fraud. Those are all areas we touch. One notable program we have is our ATOM program. And ATOM is the automated delivery of alerts on missing children. Big, long description.
And that missing ATOM. Children is like how many... Do you know any numbers on that?
Actually, currently there are 67 missing children just in Georgia.
Like today?
Today, right now, active missing children in Georgia. And we partner with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is a national center. And the partnership and the program that we've offered is about getting information out faster. So you've seen the missing children posters, right?
Right. And sometimes you get those alerts on your phone.
That's the exactly. And there are better ways to get those alerts is kind of what this program's about. Mm-hmm. So we've used our technology to get the information about the missing children out faster, but also very targeted. So there are two major pieces in finding children. One is getting the information quickly and getting it to the right areas, right? Those are the two major pieces that we've seen.
And speed is important.
Speed is, I mean, you're talking, yeah, minutes. Mean the difference between finding right. a child and not. And our technology's actually had improvements now where we can even target a piece of highway. And on that piece of highway where we think the abducted child is, we're pushing out these posters about missing children in the news and into a
and
business.
Like billboards?
It's more about the alerts. So you're talking about alerts
like
on your phone.
For your phone.
Or even a fax that's, here's the poster, get it in front of all of the mm-hmm. people at a campground, at a gas station, right? And we're targeting these areas, the kinds of business, the area. And it's about getting the information out quickly. So we've actually helped recover almost 200 children in the United States with this program. And I said, it's using our technology that is unique in a very impactful way. And that's what our ATOM program is. And in fact, if you are interested, anyone can sign up for the ATOM program.
So it's me kind of opting into an alert.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. Free program, atomprogram.com. Mm-hmm. If you go there, you can sign up. You can get the alerts. We encourage businesses to sign up as well. And then you get the information out to all your employees. So the more people it touches, the better chance we have of recovering these children.
Now, do you partner with like kind of the digital billboard companies? Because that I would think that would have some sort of an impact that, you know, as I'm driving, those things are digital,
right?
And then there it is.
Right,
and
the Amber Alerts, right?
But
right.
those things have a they're pushing a new message, I think, every 8 to 10 seconds. So mm-hmm. to add one of those to a list where it's almost kind of an infinite number of slots.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, it's really mm-hmm. about more information out
as
in
fast as possible, but
areas.
In the right places. Like
Absolutely.
It does no good to send that out, you know, to mm-hmm. another state where if the right. person it just happened here.
Absolutely. And having the alert have the information to say this is relevant to you because they were on this highway and I know that's where you are right now.
Right. Then it puts more pressure on them that, you know, they may make mm-hmm. a mistake or something like that.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. So again, great program. I think it's, us using our unique technology mm-hmm. and our abilities to, it's a new like triangulation. It's basically a geographical technology that shows like, again, a stretch of highway and we know this child's missing, get the information out quickly and targeted.
And that's LexisNexis. That's your superpower is kind of mm-hmm. all this data and then kind of,
that's right.
Kind of curating it or kind of parsing it up in ways that are meaningful for business.
That's right.
That's kind
for risk management.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But again, it's an asset that we've found has many uses. And one is helping, find these children.
Now, how does that initiative come up? Was that something that mm-hmm. the police or law enforcement said, yep. hey, you guys, can you help us in this? Or is this something that you guys say, hey, you know what, we're doing this, maybe you can help in this area?
Absolutely. So one of our we have big customers in for our risk business in the government sector. So local law enforcement all the way up to federal. And it was absolutely a need that we saw with law enforcement. Like, here's the details of this missing child or, you know, if only we could do this.
Right.
And that's when we take that in. And again, we've been doing this since 2000, actually. This partnership's been going on for quite some time. And it was because of a need. And we hear the law enforcement tell us, even in their special investigation unit, if only we could do X, Y, and Z, and in responding to that.
And then for LexisNexis Risk Solutions, when you're serving your more typical business clients, it's mm-hmm. to help them take all this big data and then mine it and use it and kind of get the most out of it.
Absolutely.
That's how you're serving your clients.
That's right. That's right. For risk assessment, again, big areas of fraud, identity theft, know your customer, right? It's about, mm-hmm. it's a lot about who you're doing business with and risk assessment.
And then is there a niche that your group specializes in?
Personally, yes. So the group that I'm responsible for is actually taking all of this data, this petabytes of data that we collect.
Petabytes. That sounds like a lot.
It is. And linking the data. So my job is to make sure when we have multiple records about a person, it is their, you know, it's public records. So we're talking about property data, right? And if it just has your name and address, understanding that that's the same person who's on this driver's license record that we also have. And connecting all of that data together. And again, I talked about the petabytes.
Right.
So it's a lot of data to connect together.
Because it could be like one typo somewhere could screw something up.
Absolutely.
Or one like middle initial somewhere
right.
could screw something up.
That's right. That's right. Data hygiene is what we call it, right? Yeah.
To make sure that you're always talking about the same person because that can impact somebody getting a loan or something if there's one mistake, right?
Right. So precision is what is really what we're after. We want to make sure that when we are offering solutions to our customers and they are asking us to help them with a transaction about a consumer, we are certain that we're talking about the same consumer, exactly to your point. We want to make sure that the right consumer is getting the right information so that they are not negatively impacted.
And then the consumer's expectations nowadays are it has to be instant, right?
Like
they want it faster and faster.
It has to be perfect.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Every time.
Every time. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's good job security for you, right?
Yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah.
So if somebody wanted to learn more about the program, want to give the URL one more time and also the LexisNexis URL.
Sure, absolutely. So LexisNexisRisk.com. But the ADAM program to sign up for alerts for missing children is ADAMprogram.com.
And then is there any information about that coding camp and all that stuff?
So that camp, actually, we go through the schools themselves.
Uh-huh.
So you would hear about it through your local school.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we've got Shane King with 3Squared. Welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So what are you doing for the planet?
Lord, I'm not doing that kind of stuff for the planet. And if she's not telling you her age when she was in school, I'm not telling you mine. But we actually started the business. We're actually located here in Buckhead in the Atlanta area. My brother and I started the business 20 years ago, basically, 99.
We're going to just talk about you, what it's like working with your brother.
Yeah, that could take about 3 hours.
I thought so.
He's my younger brother, so I had to just
get over myself. It's even worse, right?
Right, exactly. So basically, we're a digital agency. I know that means a lot of things to a lot of people. We're not an SEO company. We don't help people with search. We really are more specialist. We build websites. We build apps. And where our business is trending right now is more on the video production side of it. We've always had that as a part of it. We're really looking to expand that part of the business and keep growing because there's been a big emergence of this whole term emerging immersive media, which is basically like 360 video, augmented reality, virtual reality. All that stuff is really where video is going to be trending. So we're not just doing typical videos anymore. And that's really becoming a very specialized area, at least here early on.
Right.
You know, 10 years from now, there'll probably be a ton of companies doing this. I can guarantee you there will be. But right now, there's only a handful in Atlanta doing a lot of this stuff.
Right. We've had the opportunity to interview a lot of people in this space, and the kind of the virtual reality or the augmented reality, it comes into play in a lot of in ways that you wouldn't think in terms of like large machine companies that do trade shows that don't want to carry the machine around.
That's true. We have a company called Elekta. They're in healthcare technology, right. And they do big cancer-fighting machines, and they don't want to have to install a demo at a hospital just to rip it back out when they didn't get the job. So, yeah, I think that's going to be huge. We're also seeing, you know, training's a boring word,
right?
But training is going to be huge in this industry as far as the immersive side of things is concerned. And it's, you know, it's for a lot of obvious reasons. I mean, we already have studies that show 30-40% more retention when you use this technology rather than just having people sit there and watch a series of linear videos.
Right.
So we're really excited about it. It's the first time I think we've gotten really truly excited about where video's going since we started the business.
Well, it's kind of it has some unique challenges to the status quo, this type of video, that because it's so immersive on one hand where you're like it looks very real. You know, for any of the listeners that's never put on one of those headsets, you think you're in that space within seconds. Like, it's scary how quickly you're immersed in it. But like for like the movie industry, if everybody's wearing headsets, what's the movie world going to look like, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's great, actually. We have to help clients all the time kind of navigate it. The clients get excited about it. They've got budgeting aside. They want to do some of this stuff.
Right.
I've had a client recently, and I won't name names because he would come out and kill me. But he wanted to use it as part of sales presentations. And we said, okay, time out. We want to apply it right. We love your money, but we want to apply it right. Think about being in that boardroom setting with people around a table. You've got a whole series of people worried about their hair. They may not want to stick this on and do this right now. That's probably not the best environment for this. So we have to kind of guide clients and help them think this, especially early on. You don't want to do anything just for the money or just for the gimmick of it. It's kind of like the 360 video. It's fantastic, but it has to be applied right because it doesn't have all the bells and whistles and all the things you can do. You can't really move around. You can only turn around.
Right.
So you have to know kind of how you're going to apply it and have a strategy and a plan for that to make it work.
Right. I had the opportunity to see a car, and it was like you can change the color at a touch.
Right.
You can open a door. You can kind of zoom in and see kind of the leather, grains of the leather. Like, it was really...
And I'm assuming this was all, were you wearing the actual...
Right.
So it's photorealistic, so it looks like you're looking at that. Yeah, so you're dealing with augmented reality right there. Probably even mixed, which is where it's all going. That's the whole goal is to make it feel as real as possible. So I think those are going to be exciting ways that this thing's sort of trending up over the next 3 or 4 years.
So now when you're working, you need a client that is forward thinking and willing to take a risk.
Correct.
But then you got to kind of reel them in to manage their expectations of what it can and can't do.
That's correct. I think again, we find that we'll try to take a handful of our main clients, and like Elekta, I mentioned them, I'm giving them a lot of pub here today, but they're a perfect...
We'll send them an invoice
okay,
later.
Perfect. They're a perfect client for that. Whereas we have another client, Pregis out of Chicago, that are working with us on some training side of things. And that's what they're sort of forward thinking about because they have packaging machines. So it's kind of boring, but at the same time, they know that they've got to be able to sell a training application for this so that the people who buy their products can actually service them. But I still think you have to take your client base and look at it. I can tell you there's a handful of clients that we have that they're not a good fit for it. And it kind of stinks to have to tell them, maybe not right now.
Right.
But you know, it is what it is. It's new technology.
Right. So. And the good and the bad of that, the new technology, you can do a lot of cool things, but there are some limitations and it can't do some things that you might think it could do.
Right. And that's why I mentioned mixed reality. We got all these different terms now, but that's where it's all headed because I think you're really trying to get more away from the virtual space of it and get it more to the realistic space of it. So that it can be applied, you know, in a more realistic way. But I just think think some of the technologies for that aren't quite there yet on the mixed side. We can do a lot with augmented, but you know, mixed has still got a little ways to go.
Are you using devices that have the headset and like for your hand, the gloves and
all that stuff? So the team's worked on some stuff with Kimberly Clark. We've done some product launches for them on some pretty cool stuff over the last year. And that it's like you mentioned, a lot of it is getting used initially at a trade show, and it's kind of a proof of concept for the entire kind of corporate family there in the brand to embrace it. And then I think that's when their lights go off and they're like, can we talk about this? What if we did it with this? You know, and it gets you out of the trade show environment into it every day.
But like in a training simulation, you can create, like even if it's lift a box, they can kind of virtually lift a box.
Correct.
And they can learn how to do it. Do you have any stats that say if you go through this type of training, you're this much faster, you're doing the work?
Is it's more of the retention stuff. I would tell you that, you know, you can look at the biggest part of it is the overall broad video application. I mean, if you look at video in general, you're going to see stats that are, and I'm actually a little low on these at this point because we haven't gone back in about 6 months, but you've got stats that already tell us that 80%+ of all internet traffic is video related. You got stats that tell you 80%+ of all people staying on a website longer periods of time has to do with video. So we've got all those kinds of data points now. I don't know that there's been quite enough projects yet that tell us that, but I'm excited about getting there too.
Now, on those kind of stats, is that more of a B2C or is it working B2B as well?
I would tell you it's probably a little of both. Most of our work is concentrated in B2B. About the only B2C client we deal with is we work with Turner and Cartoon Network on some stuff. But but our main focus is B2B.
So now walk me through how one of these initiatives begin with a client. Like, so they're not doing it, and then you start working with them, and they start doing it. What is that?
Surprisingly, the process hasn't changed. It doesn't change much from traditional video. I mean, that's the one thing we kind of rein them back in on. And unless we're doing a really hardcore augmented reality project, they tend to price out very similar to what we would price something out on the regular video side of things. So we start out with the strategy, where it's going to be applied, how we're going to use the content. Then we get the scripting. And then we go out and we do the location production. We come back and post. And that's where it's kind of like tricky for people who – anybody can go out right now with the technology that's out there and grab 360 video. But how you apply other elements within that 360 video and turn it into something that's really valuable and useful, that's where we have an advantage, and a handful of other people like in this town alone have an advantage. It's something we've been playing around with now for years, and we're now able to apply because we've got clients willing to pay for it. So the post side of it can be tricky. You could just end up with a 360 video and you're like, cool.
But and you're done.
Didn't do anything for me, right? I didn't get anything out of it. So
now, are you leveraging also drones in the production?
We do. We do a lot of aerial stuff. We haven't done a pure augmented or virtual piece using the drone. A lot of our drone stuff right now has just really been just gathering the content with that. Mm-hmm. But we do see applications for being able to do that. We just shot some stuff for Shaw Floors, and we went out in one of their new plants where it's all robotic, and there's only a handful of people, and it's this gigantic facility at 75.
Those things that must look so cool in the video.
They're awesome.
Drone video.
And you take the drone in, and you fly it all around in there, and it's really cool. But
because people don't understand the scope and size and the magnitude of some of these kind of manufacturing centers.
No, and it's beautiful for that to be able to fly over and then kind of transition into the actual facility. It's a great way to show it off and show that there's a ton of technology behind something like flooring product. So
how do you work the storytelling into this? Because you could get kind of distracted by the technology part of it.
You could. I think part of it is we've had some success with some things the team's worked on with like Liberty Mutual and who's somebody else we worked on with that? I mentioned Kimberly Clark, but Eaton Lighting, I know we've worked on some stuff. I would tell you that one thing we found is we actually blend between more of a hosted type of thing where you can actually have a host involved in it and then blending that with the environment. So one example would be one of the projects we have a host, and it's about a lighting product. So we've got them in a raw basement, and it's about talking about something very, you know, for otherwise lack of a term, boring, but you're putting in lighting housing.
Right.
So the whole thing there is you started off with a host and he's talking about the product, but then as you turn around, you've got the competitor installing their product and you've got another guy installing. You're seeing the difference between the two. And I think those kind of things, that's applied very well in that scenario, because then you're able to not have to have somebody linearly again talking to you where you might lose them.
Or it's just like kind of talking points and just features
So combining the two, sort of to answer your question, I think sometimes is a way to do it.
And that is that what separates your agency, is maybe you have more of that kind of perspective, storytelling and making sure the messaging is correct and the strategy is on point.
Correct. I think the storytelling thing's been something we've been going with forever, because if you do video right, you tell good stories.
Right.
And I think you're correct in that we know that. I would say the secondary part of that is, and not to be overlooked, you got a great story, but what's the execution? So again, it's back to, there's a lot of people that can do 360 video, but there's not a lot of people that can do it well and with the strategy behind it. So mm-hmm. I think it would apply the same way for the augmented and the VR and all that stuff. So
now, where do you see things? Is it just more of all of this? And then we're just kind of figuring it out as we go?
I think that's where it's exciting. The truth is, it's like, it's technology. So we always talk about, well, video's never had much technology in it. And now we have to have developers working on some of this stuff.
I mean, really?
It's video, but the final way we're applying it and the things we're putting into it, you've got some development issues in there too that you have to work out. But I do think it's kind of sky's the limit. And then it'll all come back to what you said. The technology will become less relevant because it'll be there. And then
it's so affordable now. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you can get one of those 360 cameras for what, $100 and
you
throw
can
it.
Get
I
can that.
Put it,
you can
put
get
it
that
right
stuff.
Here.
It's,
you know,
that's, and the same way, it's the same thing like with the aerial stuff. I mean, you know, we used to fly around in helicopters and get, right. and, you know, charge clients thousands and thousands of dollars. And now we got drones that we can take out there. And that's why I'm saying it's gotten to a point to where it's a great time to be doing this, because you don't have to charge your clients for the stuff that you're having to get overhead laying on you. I think that makes it exciting. See where the technology goes.
Do you think we're at the end of the beginning?
We're at the beginning with this stuff.
We're still at the
beginning. If you look at websites, you remember it was a handful of years ago. We all saw it go from that preachy text-based website to everything went panel picture,
right.
very little text. It's the same transition you're going to see with video. I mean, you're going to turn on websites, and you do now with progressive enough companies, and most of their content on most any given page has video attached to it.
Right.
So I think sky's the limit. I think it'll be fun the next 5 years on this side of things.
So now for 3Squared, how do you see it evolving?
I actually see us going more that direction. We've always played on the content side. And like I said, we've always had video. It's been a big passion of ours. I think one thing that's...
So you're going all in.
I think we're pretty much going, let's say 80% we're going all in, right?
Is that your brother speaking or you?
Well, he came from the production side, so it's a little of both of us being hard-headed. But I think the truth is it's we play in an area as an agency where the technology part on the website is very complicated. It's hard. Like I'll give you a completely hypothetical example. We'll bring in great developers. We'll train them up. We'll do a great project for the Home Depot. Well, then the Home Depot sees how great they are and they'll hire them away. And that's right. just a trend. And you look at your resources and you say, you got to go. You go work over right. there. Take the money and do a great job. But I think that's hard to keep up with. So we kind of gravitated, took a step back and said, we do UX design work.
Right.
We do design work.
This is our superpower.
We do content. We write and we do video. And right. that's where we're good. That's where I think we're going to be for a while.
So now, do you have a challenge finding talent for this, or the young folks coming up, or just this as part of their DNA?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. They don't take quite as long to learn as if you were trying to train me on some of this stuff.
Right.
I'd be lost. I'm 47. So
right.
the young talent picks it up quick, but we're having to use the handful of great talent that we've got to train them up so mm-hmm. that we can continue to scale. But yeah, they pick things up really quick.
So now, is there still a place for kind of this down and dirty guerrilla kind of work? Or does it have to be this kind of...
You mean the construction, like, video mm-hmm. mentality work, that
well,
kind of stuff?
I mean, that's what a lot of people think. They can do this on their own because their phone or these
right.
cheap devices can do is, like, why should I pay
right.
an agency to do this?
I would tell you, as part of your strategy as a business, whether you're LexisNexis or whoever you are, whatever great brand you are, I think your strategy says it's got to be a combination of both. There's some mm-hmm. things that are very forward-facing that are being put out there in front of everybody. And then there's things you wouldn't want to hire us to do for all the time because it's going to be, you know, unaffordable. So... I think it has to be a combination.
Do you work with clients to help them kind of help themselves?
Yes. And we try to be honest and transparent about it. The truth is there's plenty of work to go around and part of their challenge is to figure out that piece that they can control internally
right.
because it's a whole new team. It's a whole new skill set.
But it's a good idea you find for most companies to equip some of their employees with some of these skills so they can just crank out some content.
I do. I think that's important because content, again, it's back to everybody wants to say content's king, but content is so key. And the more interesting your content is, it's important. So I think, every business should have a content strategy that has them involved in that as well.
So then what's your ideal prospect look like? What's the pain they're having?
We play a lot in the manufacturing side of things because product turnover is so big all the time. I would say their problem isn't really a problem. It's more of an opportunity. It's like what I said with training. Mm-hmm. Most of our clients who have product, they need some kind of training. Actually, it turns into a real business model for them because if I buy your product,
right.
I buy that cancer
It could be a new
machine.
Service that they offer is training.
Correct.
And that it's not something that they thought of. They thought they're just a manufacturer.
And we could just put some videos online. Well, right. Your opportunity
it's
is.
It's an online
that's right.
You know, library.
That's right. And you can license it to your clients. Because right. They bought the product, why don't they want to know how to keep it maintained and do these things that they might have to pay you otherwise to do? So I think that's a big opportunity too.
So you play in manufacturing, and then is it mostly Georgia-based, or do you have clients all over the place?
We have it's mostly Atlanta-based because we still try to keep ourselves small. Kind of our goal is to stay small, but to work with the big brands that make everything fun and exciting.
Right.
The budgets are there to do great things. We've got D.R. Horton's a client. They're based out of Fort Worth. We've got the Chicago client, but 80% of our business is Atlanta.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. What's the best way for somebody to find you?
Just go to 3squared.com, all spelled out, threesquared.com.
All right. Well, thank you again, Shane.
Thanks.
Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, I got Dean Monteleone with Karen. Welcome.
Good morning.
Did you learn anything there?
I learned a ton of things about technology. I was taking notes here as we were talking.
So now you know who to call for your agency, and then if you have any risk issues, you got to contact now.
Yeah, thank you both.
So tell us about Karen. How are you serving folks?
So we're a drug and alcohol treatment center. We work with patients and their families to move through the process of addiction and start to heal. Mm-hmm. Everything from early education in schools, middle schools, high schools, colleges, through direct treatment, through outpatient programs, inpatient programs. We have some residential programs, programs in colleges, what's called a sober dorm. We've been doing this for about 60 years. We're a nonprofit, started actually as a family organization. The name Karen, which is spelled C-A-R-O-N, actually comes from Dick and Catherine. It's their last name. Mm-hmm. He got sober back in the 50s and as a part of his process and his journey, he started to give back to the local community, and they used their house actually as sort of the first hub. Little by little, as they helped the local community up in Pennsylvania, gradually it expanded further and further, and one room converted to what I would call now a treatment room. And then little by little, one of the houses turned into it, and then maybe another house. And back in 58, they made it an official treatment center, and we kind of just continued slowly growing since then.
So now, are you with the Atlanta version of this, or is it based now here in Atlanta?
So we have a few different facilities. I'm here with our Atlanta branch. I actually started up in Pennsylvania at our main campus. But our journey here to Atlanta actually started probably about 6 or 7 years ago with some alumni and their families that were getting together, meeting, and they had asked for kind of a central hub, our place to meet, so they could all meet under one roof. And that started the journey, and we found a building right here, not too far in Dunwoody, right by Perimeter Mall. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing well ever since. So we have patients that come together kind of throughout the week, families come for different services. We have a parent support group, they come together, and then obviously ongoing treatment services as well.
So now, what is a treatment service? What is some of the examples of a treatment service?
Well, that can take a few different forms. We're very blessed right now in the field that we have many, many treatment options for people. When I first started in the field, we'll just say many moons ago, the only real options available were your traditional kind of 28-day program and then also maybe working with a psychiatrist. Now there's probably about a dozen or so different what we call levels of care in ways that you can work with a patient and their family. Some of that's still your traditional individual counseling where you just meet with a therapist one-on-one for about an hour. We do family work as well where you kind of work with the entire family unit. We do group counseling, which is usually about an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours of people with a common trait. So this might be like a men's group, a women's group, maybe a youth group, or different professionals like attorneys and physicians will have their own dedicated group. That's kind of your basic kind of beginning level of treatment. And then you kind of move up to more progressive and more structured care. So something like an intensive outpatient program will meet multiple times a week, usually around 9 or 10 hours or so. You have day programs, which is called a partial hospital program. This is a good probably 25, 30 hours of dedicated treatment work. So this is for someone who needs to put most of their attention towards getting well.
So in a week, they'll spend 25, 30 hours?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's often for folks that their disease has progressed reasonably far and they have a number of complex issues to
And then
to
when work we're on. Talking about addiction, addiction can be, you can be addicted to anything, right? But you primarily focus on alcohol?
Anything's kind of broad, but there's a good category.
Well, video game addiction, do you yes. handle that?
Yes. So there's two, I would say, kind of main addictions that we tend to work with. One is chemicals. So that could look like alcohol, your marijuana, your cocaine, your opiates, amphetamines, things like Adderall, things like that. Or hallucinogens, acid, mushrooms, et cetera. And then also what we've learned in the last probably 15, 20 years or so is that there are certain behaviors that mimic chemical use in the brain. Some of those are things like gambling, things like video game use, heavy internet use. Extreme exercise can mimic it as well.
So you break it down to chemical and behavior?
Yes.
Are those the two big categories?
Those are the two main ones, and oftentimes where the challenge lies is that as one addiction sort of gets sated or gets worked on. So say, for example, someone's drinking. You mentioned alcohol. Let's say they've put the bottle down for a bit. It is very, very common to see other maladaptive behaviors start to spike and rise. So, for example, they might find themselves at the gym 5-6 hours a day, which is a little more than, you know, I'll say I do. or they might find themselves in a casino a few times a week. You know, the brain chemistry that gets affected by both these processes and these chemicals actually hits the same part of the brain. So it's important when working with someone in a family to help them understand what's actually happening in their body, what's actually happening with their brain chemistry and how it's been affected by the choices that they've made, whether it's chemical or behavioral.
So then this kind of drug of choice might initially be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it could, once that's under control, like maybe they agree, okay, look, I can't drink. Now I'm working mm-hmm. all the time, right?
Great like example.
That happens.
Yep.
And then you're like, well, why are you complaining? I'm doing something positive.
Mm-hmm.
But even though that in the brain, that is kind of the same thing.
Right. That's a wonderful example. I mean, I've worked with many folks that, you know, say have stopped using their chemicals in an effort to kind of avoid some of the changes that they need to make to stay off of drinking or stay off of using whatever it is, they pick up a second, maybe third job. It does, in fact, keep them busy, certainly puts a couple extra bucks in their pocket.
But then they can rationalize it, well, that it's positive. Mm-hmm. So then why is everybody giving me a hard time?
Right. Yeah, and in that scenario, I would talk with mm-hmm. the family and say, you know, before he was working 40, 50 hours a week, but also drinking. So you kind of lost him for about 70, 80 mm-hmm. hours a week. You know, now he's working three jobs, so he's working 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and you've still lost him.
Right.
So what has really changed? You know, the only thing that's changed in that scenario is we've removed the chemical, but we haven't made the changes internally to do something different, to lead a different path.
So now it's possible to change that person's behavior so that they maybe find fulfillment or that kind of whatever, that itch doesn't get scratched in either of those manners, that it gets either goes away or gets scratched in a different, more positive manner?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the process?
Absolutely. It's absolutely possible to make changes like that. The process begins, honestly, with a very comprehensive evaluation. You know, we're talking about people, you know, and we are complex humans in many ways. And oftentimes when we talk about chemicals and chemical use, prolonged use, addiction, we're talking about months, if not years, of habits that we really need to kind of look at and just see how ingrained the chemical or the behavior has become in their life. And that all begins with an evaluation. So I would suggest working with a clinician, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, you know, particularly one that's been trained and skilled in addictions, and if possible also process addictions is where the behaviors come in. That usually looks like about an hour, hour and a half. It's a very thorough conversation. There's a lot of, I'm going to say, very sensitive questions.
Addicts lie. You may not know that.
I've heard that.
So then you got to cut through all the BS, right?
Right. And this is where, you're right. You know, part of this disease is to is designed to almost protect itself. And what that looks like in real life is that the people that we talk with that are in the throes of active use or in the throes of active addiction is they lie and manipulate because they're trying to protect something that they've become accustomed to. So this is where it is imperative, and I can't stress this enough, that when you're working with someone, you have to work with the larger system around them as well. So that could be family members.
So you can't solve the problem just with the individual.
It is incredibly difficult, and I would probably say closer to impossible to just work with that one person. It takes a team to really help a person heal once they've sort of started down this path because of the complexity and how much of their life gets affected with chemical use.
And is it true that they have to, like, if they don't admit that there's a true problem and not just give it lip service, like, yeah, I know I got a problem, and then just leave me alone for a day and then I go back to having the problem, like, you got to get them to truly kind of commit to this, right? This isn't something that it's going to be solved by them just saying, yeah, okay, I'll go. Right.
Right. And I would describe that as kind of the mid-range goal. I think what
the mid-range goal. So what's the first goal?
So the first goal is to get the person to talk with someone, a professional. Because I think a lot of families wait for that moment for the patient or the person to develop that insight of, hey, I have a problem. I've been using this for many, many years. And
that's what the family's rooting for.
That's what the family's hoping for.
That it'll solve itself by them becoming aware that, hey, maybe this isn't a great idea to be drunk every day.
Right. And the part of the problem with that logic is you're waiting for the goal to happen before you've started action. Mm-hmm. And it really is sort of a goal of treatment, a goal of the process of healing. And there's another piece to that, and that the way this particular disease works, addiction works, is that it actually short circuits the person's ability to actually have that insight. You know, the damage that's caused with chemicals hits that very old school part of our brain where the spinal column meets the top of the brain. It controls our emotional regulation, it controls our impulse control, and it actually short circuits the pathway that, you know, your average person would say, this feels like a bad idea. You know, I've just spent my whole paycheck on whatever it is, you know, a pile of cocaine or a keg of beer. I should probably not do this. You know, that's a rational thought process.
Right.
The person that has been using chemicals for a patterned period of time, that very area of the brain gets damaged. And the message can't get to the forefront of our brain where we would stop and think and say, hey, this feels like a bad idea. So
their head, they think it's a good idea, right? Like, this is the goal is, I would love to have a keg of beer right now. I have a keg of beer. So that's mission accomplished, right?
Mm-hmm. The thought processes get shorter and shorter and shorter, and they become more and more impulse driven. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, in a healthy brain, we sit down, we think through things, we consider various options, and, you know, we usually make a reasonably healthy decision. With the addicted brain that's been damaged from chemical use, it doesn't get that far.
But you can heal that over time, where they'll then be able to delay gratification?
Yep. That's the beauty of our bodies and brains. As humans, we were designed incredibly malleable, and if we allow our brains to heal itself, it will. The problem is we have to get out of our own way. And as people, we also tend to have a difficult time doing that.
So does the treatment that you guys implement, does it work for things that maybe aren't that hardcore addictive? Like, say if a person wants to lose 20 pounds, would the same methodology work to improve the person's choices in something that's less of an addiction and more of just a behavioral change?
Mm-hmm. Some of the behavioral changes and interventions that we do to help people through the addictive process have what I'll call kind of a rollover effect. It has a great rollover effect to their relationships, other changes that they might want to make, like you mentioned, weight loss. Because really, healing from addiction is a comprehensive healing process. It in some respects, when they're using, it damages most areas of their lives. You know, their relationships, oftentimes work, school for young people, certainly financial, you know, it's an expensive habit. And the healing process has to take into account all the areas that have been affected. And there's a number of strategies, techniques, therapeutic approaches, behavioral skills that people can learn, and also communities that can help support and sustain a person while they're doing all of this. So the effects of healing and the benefit of getting well is exponential to kind of the damage that has often been done. It's actually a really beautiful journey to see someone and their family start to heal, because it just affects so many things in their lives in a very positive way.
Now, what's a realistic timeline for healing?
Part of it depends on how long they've had patterned use with their chemicals. If you have someone, for example, who maybe has been using for 5, 10, 15 years, those are a lot of habits to unravel. So we might be looking at probably a year or two before you really kind of take a different perspective on it. For people who maybe have only been using for short periods of time, let's say like less than a year, they've usually got a good solid base of skills, but have just started to sort of stray. That's usually easily kind of correctable in a shorter period of time. Part of the challenge comes in is also the age at which they started to use. You know, our bodies are reasonably well formed and solid and structured from about mid-20s and up. So if you look at sort of the inverse of that, when we're younger, when we're 12, 14, 18, et cetera, and we're starting to use chemicals, the damage that we're doing to our brain isn't formed yet. The defenses haven't been built yet. So we're doing an incredibly powerful amount of damage to a very raw brain. That there takes a while to heal as well. So if you have someone who started using maybe in their teens, you have to get a very specific look at sort of what areas have been damaged and then more aggressively kind of work to heal that versus someone who maybe starts using later in life, that it's a little bit more narrow, the impact.
Now, when you're working with people, are you working typically with individuals or do you go into companies and say, hey, we can offer this program to your company? How do the patients kind of find you?
The easiest way to find us is to call. We have our number here at 678-624-0930 or the website. I suggest the website because it gives you a chance to kind of meet the team and sort of see us and a little bit more about us. And that's caron.com. .org.
Now, but you, like, if a company says, look, we have maybe some of our people that are struggling with this, is there something that a company can go and talk to you and maybe start a support group or something like that? Or do you do that for companies, or is this something that everybody just gets funneled to your center?
No, there's a few ways that companies can get resources for their staff, for their employees. One is, as you mentioned, kind of have support groups for those who are really at any stage of struggling with this. Mm-hmm. And that could
and
be
it could be family members that have people that are struggling with this, right? It doesn't have to just be the addict.
Right. Ideally, there's resources
for everybody, right?
You know, for the person and for them. Also, I would highlight most companies will have what's called an employee assistance program that allows their staff to reach out for help and get a little guidance as to what to do next.
Right.
I find that's the most important pivot point for families is they can usually identify something's wrong, that it's not working for their family, but they're not quite sure what to do next.
Next step, right?
Right.
And there's a lot of information on the internet and a lot of bad information on the internet.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusing.
It's a double-edged sword there, right?
Confusing information on the internet. I'm always biased towards science and the research because they've sort of followed a process and allowed us to learn a bit. However, there's a lot out there. You know, the youth that I work with, you know, call it Dr. Google. You know, you can post a lot of information with very little
research. Or just somebody, this worked for me, and then all of a sudden people think it'll work for them.
Right.
So now, for you, what's is this opioid crisis, is that keeping you guys the most busy lately?
Well, there's actually two kind of crises happening simultaneously right now here in the kind of Georgia region. Certainly the opioid crisis, it's a nationwide epidemic. And then also actually very quietly behind the scenes, we are in the throes of actually an amphetamine epidemic as well. We have more or less for two generations right now that have grown up on amphetamine-based medications that have...
Like the attention deficit disorder?
Attention deficit, things like Adderall, Ritalin.
Aren't they like opposites, like the opioids are depressant and the amphetamines?
Mm-hmm. They're very opposite. So these epidemics are happening concurrently. But what happens is we have two generations of young people that have been raised with the solution in mind of...
Medication,
right. Chemical first, and to manage a myriad of symptoms. And the unfortunate drawback to that is that they've missed the component of how to handle stress in life in situations like that through more behavioral measures or through their own self.
So just the coping skills of how to handle things just by handling things rather than medicating yourself to handle things.
Right. All right, and unfortunately,
so there's ramifications. So you're saying there's now that right. that bill's about to be paid.
Yeah. So the consequence to that is if you take amphetamines, which are do a swift amount of damage in a short period of time to the brain, or opiates that also do a swift amount of damage in a short period of time to the brain, and you take that to a young audience in a very raw brain, and then you limit the natural coping skills we would kind of normally undergo, we've caused a lot of damage to a young person's brain without the sort of background skills to help respond to life, to stress. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that pattern evolves. So one of the things that we do try to put a lot of attention towards is early education in schools to help kids and families understand, you know, there's more options out there than just chemical-based solutions.
Well, Dean, thank you so much for sharing your story. Again, the website is caron.org, caron.org. If you have any questions regarding addiction or if you have somebody in your family struggling with this, that is a call I think that everybody should make. And mm-hmm. it's here in Atlanta, the whole metro area you cover, mm-hmm. or Georgia, the whole state of Georgia, yep. that office?
Not too far from Perimeter Mall.
Good stuff, Dean. Thank you so much. Such mm-hmm. important work.
Oh, thank you.
This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.